I've listened to quite a lot of podcasts on Hacker Public Radio where the hosts talk about how they've got into free and open source software. Now, what I'm going to do in this episode is similar, but I'm going to adopt a slightly different approach in that I've been involved with computers for a good 30 years, so I'm going to talk about some of the hardware and the software I've come across. I'm going to describe what it was like to use it. With a bit of luck, it might stir some memories for anyone who, like me, has been around the scene for a while. Because, if your only experience has been with modern kit, some of the things we used to have to do may be quite surprising. When I left school in the mid-1970s, I did all sorts of jobs, but my first real contact with computers came when I started working for a company that did payroll and stock control for other companies, other firms. You've got to remember that in those days, any kind of computer was seriously expensive, so small firms just really couldn't afford one. It was quite common to outsource data processing to specialist companies, but it wasn't called outsourcing then, of course. Anyway, this firm I worked for used, they were what were described as microcomputers, and they were made by two American firms. Now, one was called the Ontel Corporation and the other was Jacquard's. Now, I didn't have that many dealings with the Jacquard machines, but the Ontel ones were actually quite impressive. They looked a bit like a stylish TV set with a keyboard attached to the front. You ran them from a pair of 7-inch floppy disks, and one ran the operating system and the application software, and the other one was used to store the data. Now, if you wanted to change from payroll to, say, word processing or stock control, you had to switch the machine off, then insert another system floppy that had the new program on it, and then boot it up again, and that was pretty tedious, as you'd imagine. But something I'll never forget is the sound the printers made. They were daisy wheel printers, and they worked like a typewriter, with each character being rammed against an inked ribbon at very high speed, and that left an impression on the paper that was behind. Now, you could often tell what was being printed just by the rhythm, because things like invoices and statements had fixed layouts, so the sound of the printing of the column headers and lines was repeated over and over again. Now, while I worked at that firm, they got their first hard disks. Now, they looked a bit like a single drawer filing cabinet. You pulled open the drawer and placed the disk inside on a sort of turntable. And this was called a Winchester disk, and it looked a lot like a dustbin lid. And it held a whopping 10 megabytes of data. Now, the drawer also contained a fixed disk at the bottom, and that was another 10 meg. So if you wanted to copy a disk to make a backup or whatever, you copied your data down from the removable disk to the fixed disk, then back up to another removable disk. Because that process would have been quite commonplace in those days, it may possibly be the origin of the term backup. Now, those disk drives cost something like £3,000 a piece, and in the early 80s that was a serious amount of money. But after working at that firm, I spent a few years in the defence industry. At the start, I was just a technical clerk, and this meant I was doing essentially clerical work, but you needed a technical understanding of the products. Now, somehow I managed to convince them that I had enough knowledge of engineering and electronics to do the job, but in reality, I was desperately trying to teach myself as I went along. But after I'd been there a year or so, I got called to the personnel department and they asked me if I'd be interested in being trained to be an analyst programmer. Now, that was quite a trendy job to do, a bit like being a web designer is now, so I thought, why not? But before I could start the course, I had to pass this aptitude test. It was run on some sort of handheld, I think it was an HP handheld computer, looked a lot like a big calculator. But the questions didn't seem to have much to do with computing. They were all about personality, asking what I would do in different situations. They seemed to be assessing whether I was a psychopath rather than whether I was being good as a programmer. But anyway, I passed the aptitude test and I went on this course and I was taught how to program in Fortran 77, which I've got to admit, I didn't really find that all that difficult. But after that, I was put in a team whose job it was to analyse test results. And the computers we were using then were DECVAXes, and they ran the VMS operating system. Now, the strong point about VAXes was that they could be clustered to look like one huge, powerful machine. In the computer room, there were dozens of them, and each one was about the size of a large filing cabinet. They developed so much heat that the computer had some very serious air conditioning to keep everything cool. Now, that was great in the summer because you'd keep finding excuses to go in the computer room and cool down, because the rest of the building we were working in was glass-sided, and on hot days it was like a sauna. Now, we used to access the VAX clusters through VT100 terminals. Because they were completely dumb, you could just sit down anywhere you liked and do your work. So really, we were hot desking long before that term was invented. As well as the VAX, there was also what we like to refer to as our supercomputer, though, you know, by modern standards it wasn't. It was called an Alexi, and it ran an operating system called MBOS. You didn't have to learn a whole new set of commands, fortunately, because it also ran a VMS emulator, so if you could use the VAX, you could use the Alexi. But we didn't really get much opportunity to use it, because it was for the really heavy-duty stuff, like simulations. Now, the software I was testing was used to control a torpedo. It was programmed using a language called Coral 66, which was a lot like Fortran in many respects, but it didn't have any floating point capability. You had to use fixed point arithmetic, and that took a bit of getting used to, I have to say. What I find amazing, though, looking back, is that this torpedo had a complete guidance and countermeasure system stored in 48K of memory. I mean, these days, a Hello World executable in Windows must be about half a meg. But the secret was that every variable was optimised and no bits were wasted. So an 8-bit word might be subdivided to define two variables needing a maximum of 4 bits each, or might be used for 8 separate booleans. But it's hard to imagine that now, because memory and storage is so cheap nowadays, I think it's actually made us quite sloppy. Because I doubt that the people who write compilers would know where to start if you gave them those sort of constraints these days. But about that time, the term fourth generation programming language started to appear, but really nobody had a firm idea of what it meant. It was different things to different people, really. One interpretation was the generation of code from graphical modelling tools. So, you know, in tune with the vogue of the time, I got sent on a course to a place near Heathrow Airport to learn a thing called Jackson Structured Programming. It had been invented by a bloke called Michael Jackson, so I was half expecting to have the instructor moonwalking across the classroom, but didn't happen, of course. Now, JSP was more or less flowcharting. You use boxes to define statements and conditions, and lines to show the process flow. You still need to know the syntax of the programming language, though, that you wanted to generate when you'd finished working on the diagrams. But VT100 terminals only worked in text mode, so the diagrams were limited to shapes which could be created using ASCII codes. So it really looked quite crude, but it was effective. I suppose JSP was quite good in theory. It certainly made it easier to understand what was going on in a program than reading the raw code was. But the trouble was, if you just wanted to make a small change, it was a hell of a lot faster to just type it directly into the source code. Otherwise, you had to change the model and regenerate everything. But configuration did become a bloody nightmare, and JSP eventually fell by the wayside. It was one of those good ideas that just didn't quite work in practice. But at that firm, I had my first exposure to the Mac and the IBM PS2. An original Mac booted up from a single 3.5-inch floppy disk. But since it only had one drive, you often had to keep switching disks over when you were saving your work. Now, that was a bit of a pain. But the mouse and the graphical interface were quite a novelty. By comparison, the PS2 was still running command line DOS. As I remember it, if you wanted to network two Macs together, you just ran a cable from one to the other and that was it. But to network two PS2s together, you had to buy a dedicated network card for each one, then install all sorts of driver software. But even then, it was quite unreliable, so you still ended up using floppy disks to exchange files half the time. Another thing I came across for the first time was a laptop. It was made by an American firm called Grid. It had a small flat screen that displayed orange characters on a black background. You booted up from a floppy disk, but it also had an optional hard disk in a separate unit, which you connected whenever you need it, and that was about the same size as the computer was itself. Now, those grids were usually used to record test results at firing ranges. But once I was coming up a flight of stairs carrying a grid hard disk, and I had the grid computer sitting on top of it. Now, metal against metal can be quite slippery, and the computer fell off and went bouncing down the stairs. But these things were about $5,000 apiece. But nobody else was around, so I quickly picked it up and I decided the best course of action would be to just deny any knowledge of how the damage happened. The casing was scratched anyway from being used on board ships, so it wasn't that obvious which damage was new. Anyway, I got the thing into the computer room and I plugged it all together and switched it on. And it all fired up perfectly, I just couldn't believe it. The grid had fallen about 4 foot vertically and then slid down about a dozen concrete steps. You try and imagine a modern laptop survive an accident like that. My next job was at a large stockbroking company where they used quite a mixture of hardware. They had faxes, IBM AS400s, PCs running DOS and PCs running OS2. They also had a few copies of Windows too, but at that time nobody was really interested in it. They used a DOS office suite called SmartWare 2. It was essentially text mode, but it still supported multiple windows and supported a word processor, a database, and a form designer. I really don't remember if it had a spreadsheet or not. I had to learn to use COBOL in double quick time, as it was a language they used to write a lot of the company's management systems. Now, after Fortran and Crawl 66, COBOL seemed quite quaint to me, but it wouldn't have been much use in defence systems, but financial stuff it was actually great. Its syntax was about as close to natural language you could get. If you wanted to add two numbers together, the syntax would be LX to Y giving Z. This made the code very easy to read, and I suppose if you chose your variable names carefully, it was to some extent self-documenting. I didn't really like working on the AS400. It didn't have the concept of a current directory and file paths. Instead, you had a library list, and a program would access the instance of any dependency which was highest up that list. Now, this could cause all sorts of problems on developed machines where you might have different versions of an object all over the place. But as time went by, I found myself working more on PCs than the VAXs or the AS400s, and I spent a lot of time developing software to validate data going to and from the London Stock Exchange. Now, most of this was done using Ball and Turbo C, which I had to teach myself from a few books. I tried programming for Windows, which then was, I think, at version 3.1, but it's so complicated and far too much like hard work. And so, because a GUI wasn't essential for the stuff I was working, I just gave up on concentrating on writing command line applications. But all this changed when Visual Basic came out. I mean, suddenly you could produce Hello World programming Ball and C, which was 300 or 400 lines long, and in Visual Basic it was probably about 3 lines long. Now, some of my colleagues played around with Ball and Delphi, which was sort of halfway house between Visual Basic and Ball and C. It was based on Pascal, and they reckoned it was quite good, but I didn't really know much Pascal. And so consequently, I didn't use it very much, so I was never in a place to judge. But I think it became quite a popular tool in the marketplace. And when object orientation became the vogue, we started using Ball and Turbo C++, which came on about 20 floppy disks and a box full of manuals. And it was, I'm not exaggerating, about 2 foot wide. I have to say, though, for the stuff we were developing, object orientation was really a waste of time. You'd find yourself spending ages designing classes and inheritance hierarchies, which really didn't need to exist, so you could say your application was object-oriented. But don't get me wrong, object orientation has its uses, like for developing GUIs and anything with dynamic objects and that sort of thing, but most business applications don't really need it. As I was using PCs more and more, I decided I'd get one for myself to use at home. A PS2 like the ones I was used to would have been far too expensive, but the Amstrad clone of the IBM PC had come out, and that was selling like hotcakes. Now, I managed to get one through somebody I knew who had connections at Dixon's, but even so, it was still over £400. My machine was a PC1512, which came with a CGA black and white monitor, 512k of memory, and 2 5¼-inch floppy disks. But over time, I replaced the 5¼ with 3.5-inch disks, because they could store 720k each instead of, I think it was 360 on the 5¼. Before long, I got shot with one of those, and I replaced it with a 20 MB hard disk. Now, this cost me the best part of £200. Looking back, it seemed like madness, but at the time, I wondered what I was going to do with all that additional storage, because without video or audio files, it's surprising just how little storage you really needed. Now, I used the Amstrad mainly for playing around writing programs for my own amusement. I used a copy of Baller and Turbo C that I'd pirated from work. When I bought it, the Amstrad came with DOS 3.1 and it had an application called GEM. And this sat on top of DOS and it provided quite an effective GUI. I suppose it was aimed at people who didn't know any DOS commands, so I didn't really get to use it very much. But it was pretty good at the time. The Amstrad mouse was a strange bit of kit. It didn't use a serial port like every other mouse on the market. It had a proprietary connector which no other manufacturer used. It didn't generate signals in the standard way either. A normal mouse used a DOS interrupt to notify the operating system of all its events like movements and mouse clicks. But the Amstrad mouse just sent ASCII codes that equated to the up, down, left and right arrow keys. As an experiment, I did once install Windows 3 on the Amstrad, but it was so slow it's completely unusable. Another Amstrad device I bought was a thing called the NC100 Notepad. It was about the size of a sheet of A4 paper and probably less than an inch thick. And it only had 64k memory, but it would run all day on a set of 4 AA batteries. It was never a realistic alternative to a laptop, and in all fairness, it wasn't designed as that. But if you couldn't afford a laptop, it was great for typing the stuff up when you're on the move, because you could always then copy it back to a proper computer using a serial cable. My next computer after that was another Amstrad, but this time it was a 4386SX. It had quite a decent spec and it had quite a high resolution colour monitor. Now, this monitor was only about 10 inches across, and because of that it gave you a razor sharp image which seemed to impress everybody who ever looked at it. The trouble with the stockbroking world is that the type of applications you develop gets a bit limited after a while, so I moved on. I went back into the defence industry. But this time I had to be a jack of all trades. I helped out in any project where they were short-staffed. Now, sometimes it'd be a few months and other times it might just be a week or two. So you name it, I did it. Design, coding, testing, spec writing, acceptance, implementation, the old bit. There was a little bit of Fortran around still, but most of the programming was done using C++. They used Microsoft Visual Studio. Now, I can't deny it's very powerful, but I found Visual Studio to be total overkill. There seemed to be a widespread belief that you could only be taken seriously if you used C or C++. In fact, I'd have said that most of the projects I got involved with could have been completed in a fraction of the time and probably just as effectively using Visual Basic. But for some reason, VB was viewed as a noddy development environment, so I only ever really used it for prototyping. A lot of programmers tried to show how clever they were at C++ by making the code look as complicated as they possibly could. You get three or four nested statements in a single line where using separate lines and a bit of indentation would have made it so much more readable and maintainable. But as for meaningful comments, well, forget it. The company had coding standards and they called for programmers to use comments wherever the code was not blindingly obvious. But in reality, it got exactly the opposite. You'd have a hugely complicated 100-line function with no comments at all. Then you'd find a statement like A equals B plus C, with a comment above it saying A is the sum of B and C. That was very helpful. But gradually I found myself doing less programming and more design and documentation. But after one huge configuration management cock-up, where somebody overwrote about 1,000 lines of mission-critical code with a load of crap and without any backup, so I managed to persuade the company to adopt Microsoft SourceSafe, which was a configuration control tool. Now, you can link it to Visual Studio, so that made it much easier for a programmer to work within the rules and try and bypass them. We used a design tool called Rational Rows, and that could also be linked to SourceSafe. In some respects, Rational Rows employed a lot of the same concept as the Jackson tools I'd used about a dozen years earlier. Now, one thing which always struck me as something of a paradox, and still does to this day, in fact, is that organisations go to great lengths to manage the configuration of source code in engineering drawings, but they don't apply near as much control to the documentation that generates the work in the first place. In my experience, the specification may have to be signed off, but there's usually precious little evidence that any of the changes have been studied at all. You could easily waste millions of quid through a project working to an incorrect spec, and it does happen. And documentation has become my main area of work these days, because a lot of people seem to have lost the ability to write coherently, and other people are just too busy, so what documentation they do have to produce is rushed, and that leads to all sorts of problems with inaccuracy and poor clarity. But it's not just in the IT industry, same issues apply in just about every other walk of life. I spend a lot of my time reauthoring documents just to make them fit for purpose, and advising companies on how to manage and exploit their documentation. A feature of the defence industry is that it has a huge appetite for cash. The products are expensive, and there's an implicit expectation that the solution to any requirement is going to be expensive as well. I often struggle to be taken seriously when I propose any low-cost solutions. The attitude was that if the system wasn't bespoke, or at least had lots of noughts at the end of its price tag, it couldn't be that much good. I saw applications intended for a handful of users developed an Oracle or SAP with an Access database or even a shared spreadsheet could have done the job perfectly well. Now, one of the few occasions I did convince the powers that be to use software they already had instead of buying new stuff in, I put an application developed in Access on a Citrix server, and that supported users all over the world for a tiny fraction of the cost of a so-called professional solution. So I'm a big fan of Citrix. It gets around so many network constraints. The first time I went on the internet was in about 1995 or maybe 96. I picked up a free CompuServe disk in a shop and I thought I'd give it a try. But by then I had a Packard Bell laptop with a dial-up modem built in, so it was just a matter of installing the software and running a wire into a phone socket. By ADSL standards it was very slow, but it still seemed pretty impressive to me. I mean, I don't think there was a BBC website then, so the news and most of the content came through the CompuServe portal. I didn't use CompuServe all that long, because I think it might have been some kind of free trial, so it was probably only a month or so. But somebody told me that AOL was much better, so I gave that a go instead. But as far as I can recall, everything came through AOL software. You couldn't just open an AOL connection and then do your own thing. So when FreeServe opened up, they offered a service that was more like what people have today. They provided the connection, then you could do whatever you wanted. that's when I started using the Netscape browser, and then later on I moved on to Internet Explorer. Before Google came to be as big as it is, I used Alta Vista as my main search engine. But once Google had Maps, which I found I used a lot, it was game set and match to Google. Over the years, I've used every version of Windows, Windows 2 onwards, except I don't think I've used Windows ME. But the only ones which never really gave me any real problems were NT4 and Windows 7. Now, I've visited big companies all over Europe, and I think it's significant that the vast majority are still running XP. I've not heard of anybody actually buying Windows 8 from choice. Everyone I know who's got it has got it through buying a computer that had it pre-installed. Now, having spent a day using it, I know I'd never buy anything Windows 8 on it. Or if I did, I'd wipe it immediately. I can't believe how bad it is. It's unintuitive and it looks crap as well. Well, if you think Windows and Windows software, though, you have to acknowledge that it's spectacularly powerful. That's probably the foundation of Microsoft problems, because most users only use a small fraction of the functionality in, say, Office. So by definition, this means that any new features Microsoft add are going to be of little use to most people. So the only way they can make a new version distinctive is by changing the way it looks. So that's largely change for the sake of change. And when I used XP Pro as my operating system at home, I got utterly fed up with the 5 minutes or so it took to boot up every time, and in long periods of the system hanging with just the hourglass for company while a scanner update took place. There's no way I was going to buy a Mac, so I looked around for an alternative system. I'd heard of Linux, but I didn't really know much about it. Until then, I don't think I understood the distinction between Linux and Unix. I'd used Sun Spark stations a little bit, but I was never really impressed with their user interface, so Windows always seemed way ahead. When I discovered Ubuntu, all that changed. I downloaded 8.4 and ran it for a while from a live CD, and that in itself was something of a new concept. It took ages to boot up from a CD, but once it was running, the performance was okay. So after about a week or so, I was completely sold. There was almost nothing I wanted to do that I couldn't do on Linux, because I'm not a gamer, so there's no problem on that score. So I installed 8.04 properly on my home PC, which at that time was a compact desktop. Now, I've not really looked back since. I tried Unity when it came out, but I just couldn't get comfortable with it. I prefer a more traditional type of desktop. It's something that Microsoft did get right away from day one. You know, Windows 8 has changed that, of course. I got around the Unity problem by using XFCE instead. Just lately, though, I've started to have real misgivings about Ubuntu, because whatever Canonical say, it's pretty obvious that the gap between them and the community is getting wider all the time. And it's the community aspect of Linux, which is one of the things I find so appealing. So I think if you fast forward a couple of years, Canonical will either have blown it and disappeared, or they'll look more like Apple do today, though probably nothing like as big. But recently I've migrated all my computers to Linux Mint Debian Edition. It's absolutely rock solid, so I'd recommend anyone give it a try. A few months ago my daughter got an iPad. Now I appreciate the screen's fantastic and the build quality is superb, but I wouldn't want one for myself. I expect to be able to do whatever I want my computers. On the iPad you can't even get to the file system. So for a non-techie user, I can see the appeal of a tablet if you just want to browse the internet and watch videos. But for the serious business user, I think there'll always be a place for a keyboard and mouse. Your touch-enabled screens have their uses, but can you imagine how your shoulders would ache if you spent all day with your arms outstretched in front of you moving things around the screen? Now, the same applies to voice recognition. It's a great technology, has got huge potential for all sorts of devices and people are disabled and that. But would you want to be in an office with everybody talking to their computers all day? There'd be no privacy, and I think it'll sound more like bedlam. One of the main lessons I've learnt in my 30 odd years in IT is that there are many developments driven by a desire for change as by a real need for change. There's an awful lot of technologies that were going to be the future, and now they're history, and I can see Flash and even Java going much the same way over the next few years. But the other lesson is that fundamentally good concepts don't ever really go away. Now, when I started out, all your applications ran on a central server. You only had to install one instance of it, and all the users got the benefit immediately. Now everything's web-based, and you only install one instance of the application on the server, and all the users get the benefit immediately. So, despite all the changes in between, nothing has really changed, and I expect that cycle to keep on going in the future. Bye for now.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.